Got drafted by the New York Rangers in 1991. Started with the New York Rangers, and then after the Olympics in 1994, started having debilitating panic attacks. Eventually, I would get diagnosed with obsessive compulsive disorder. I got traded to Vancouver, but was playing with a mental illness that I was hiding. And then ultimately, like any other mental illness or any other physical injury, you have to deal with it.
Our guest today is a former NHL goalie with an impressive career, including playing for the New York Rangers, the Vancouver Canucks, and winning an Olympic silver medal. He's also a published author, keynote speaker, and mental health advocate. We are honored to have Corey Hirsch with us today to discuss his personal experience living with a mental illness and his life beyond the rink. Despite achieving his dream of becoming a professional hockey player and having a so-called perfect life, well, at least from the outside, Corey found himself having suicidal thoughts at the age of 21.
Corey revealed a side of his life to the public in an essay published in the Players' Tribune. He was one of the first professional athletes to talk about mental health, and his essay is still one of the most read articles for the publication. Corey's essay exposed the unseen battles that athletes face beyond the spotlight.
With his 2022 memoir, The Save of My Life, My Journey Out of the Dark, Corey not only delves into his hockey career, but also the onset of his mental health challenges and his diagnosis of obsessive compulsive disorder. Corey shares the courage it took to seek help as a professional athlete. His memoir not only narrates his personal journey, but also emphasizes his mission to eradicate the stigma surrounding mental illness.
His post-hockey career has been diverse, working as a goaltending coach and radio analyst, but we want to hear more of Corey's story that was not in the public spotlight. His story serves as a beacon, shedding light on the importance of discussing mental illness and paving the way for a more compassionate and understanding society. Corey, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be on, and all those kind words you guys are saying about me, I don't know what to do with those right now.
So for those of us that are not familiar with your story and haven't read your memoir yet, let's go back to that difficult and dark time when you were 21 and you were thinking about taking your own life.
Well, I mean, it was a time where the stigma was obviously real. I think we're in a better place now. I was 21 years old. I was playing with the New York Rangers. I was the third goalie in the Stanley Cup run when I guess I just described things as everything just kind of almost like two wires disconnected. OCD is a little bit different in the sense of depression and anxiety and all those. Most people I know can tell you exactly where they were, the day, the time, the place where the light flip just switched. And back then, there's no education. There's nothing in high schools or middle schools or anything. And I had no idea what even mental illness was or depression or anxiety. So when this just kind of happened, I didn't know what to do. I didn't know where to go. I didn't know where to turn. All I knew was I wasn't really able to tell anybody. And that's where the suicidal thoughts came from, was because I looked everywhere for some sort of self-diagnosis or hope or help or anything, and barely being able to function, throw depression on top of that, throw the shame of having these thoughts, and it just leads to almost the perfect storm. And I got to the point where I didn't feel like there was any help or any hope. And it almost took a bad turn, but I'll save you the details. I live at the end of my book. I'm still here and I'm happy I'm still here. I had to look up to see rock bottom. And here I am 30 years later. I've got three children. I've got a successful career. But there was a point where I couldn't see any of that. This is why I've written the book. This is why I'm on the podcast. This is why I'm a mental health advocate, is to show people that it does get better. You can be in those places of despair, but it does get better. There's always a path ahead. We're in a much better place now than we were when I was sick.
So inspirational. Was there a pivotal moment when you decided to speak publicly about your mental illness?
Yeah, I met another player that was in a treatment facility for fentanyl and alcohol. And he was actually an active player, quite younger than I was. I met him and we went for coffee. And for some reason, I hadn't really told anybody my story. And when I met him and just spewed out my stuff, he looked at me and he said, "That's exactly what happened to me," right? And I'd really never met anybody that had OCD like I did. But here's the difference, is that he told me his mom had to resuscitate him twice from fentanyl overdoses, right? Wow. So It was then that I sat there and I was like, boy, this is pretty serious stuff. And if there's other people out there that I can help with my story that don't have to suffer in silence, I needed to get my story out there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And speaking of mothers, You're quite close with your mom.
Oh, yeah. My mom's great. She was one of the first people I told that something was wrong. But here's the thing. You look at her generation, a mental illness meant you went to the asylum, right? Mm-hmm. And that you didn't come out if you went in. And if you did come out, you were a completely different person. So my mom didn't know what to do either. She had no idea where to go. And I begged her not to actually talk to anybody or tell anybody because I was worried it was going to ruin my NHL career. So I still had that in the back of my mind too, is how am I going to play in the NHL with a mental illness?
Yeah.
Wow. How difficult was it for you to decide to come out and talk about your struggles publicly? Was there a long time where you deliberated about it, or after speaking with that other hockey player, was it a pretty quick decision?
Is 20 years a long time? From diagnosis to coming out with my story, it was almost 20 years. So yeah, it was extremely difficult. And it was until I got older and comfortable with who I was as a human being and stopped worrying about what everybody else thinks, that's when I felt it was okay to do so. We're finally in a place where mental health and mental illness is being looked at seriously and not being shunned and thrown under the rug like it used to be. And we're actually helping people. So we're in a much better place. But yeah, I was terrified before the story came out.
Yeah, we've definitely come a long way. What impact did sharing your mental illness journey and your story publicly have on your life?
Oh, it changed my life completely. I was terrified before the article came out. I didn't know what it was going to do, but it changed my life from going one of having my life be about me to having one about helping others. And when you're a hockey player, it's all about you. It's all about how you played, what the coach is saying, what the fans are saying, this, that, me. And when you get out of the game and no one's looking for Corey Hirsch anymore, you have to figure out what life's all about. What I learned after the article came out is that life's about helping other people. It really is. And you get it back tenfold. When you help others, the flow in the circles is that you get it back yourself. And it's made my life feel like I've had a life of significance and purpose, and that hopefully I can leave a legacy that my children are proud of, that I'm proud of, that my grandchildren are proud of.
Corey, when you released your essay in 2017 and then your memoir just a couple of years ago, what comments did you receive from the public, from your family? Was there backlash? I'm just curious as to what you heard from others.
Yeah, there was not one negative comment. It was more of a celebration, I would say. And I think the hardest part was a lot of my friends didn't know the depth of what had gone on or didn't even know about it. So they were all feeling like almost bad that they didn't recognize it or they weren't be able to help me. And that wasn't what it was all about, but they showed a lot of compassion for me and very supportive. And that's the thing of what I always say to people. If you're struggling out there coming forward with what you struggle with, don't be. The love and support will be overwhelming. And if someone isn't loving and supportive, well, they're not your people. Go find your people because there's more of us than there are of them.
Well said.
Definitely. Thank you.
And Corey, you're also living in a world of guys and macho and hockey, and you're surrounded by testosterone. So I can imagine how much more difficult and challenging it would have been as a professional NHL hockey player to come out.
Well, yeah, no question. But here's the thing. This is why I advocate for what I do. I work with a wellness company. And what we do is we go into construction companies and talk to middle-aged men in general, because they've exactly what you just said. 3 in 4 suicides are male. We have a huge middle-aged man crisis because we typically have been taught historically that you should be able to figure it out on your own, that a man figures it out on their own, that they suck it up and that they don't tell anybody, and that if you can't figure it out, you're somehow less of a man, which is complete garbage. You break your leg and you're a man, it's okay to go get your leg fixed, right? But your brain, something goes wrong and it's like, no, that's not, it's archaic and there's a better life out there. Not to discount our females, because they're slowly catching in suicide rates too. It's a global issue, but for men, it seems to be a lot more because of our masculinity, what it needs to be a man. And we need to redefine what it means to be a man. And that means not having to suffer in silence.
I like that, having to redefine what it means to be a man. Well said. And as we talked about earlier, Corey, you do not have schizophrenia. However, in your essay that was published in the Players Tribune, you talk about hearing voices or having thoughts. And I'm just going to quote something you said, which is pretty powerful. You write, "The dark thought wouldn't go away. It kept repeating and repeating. I was actively trying to get it out of my head, but the more I tried, the more I couldn't stop thinking about this horrible, dark, ridiculous thought. The thought hammered me, and I started freaking out. I could barely breathe." Could you just tell us a little more about these intrusive thoughts that you had at that time?
Yeah. With OCD, what happens is we have millions and millions of thoughts every day, right? But my brain, I think it's the amygdala, it overfires, right? It over tries to protect me. And so every thought becomes an emergency rather than just dismissing them. And the way I describe it best is we've all been driving our car down two-lane roads or whatever, and you have that silly thought of, what if I accidentally swerve my car into the other? Oh, there'd be carnage and destruction and all. It's just a thought. You have a million of them. We have ones that mean something. Majority of them mean nothing. Someone like me would pay so much attention to it that it would freak me out. I'd have panic attacks over it because I would never, ever want something like that to happen, to the point I would stop driving my car. Well, a non-OCD brain would go, that was a silly thought, and they'd go on with their day, and they wouldn't even think about it again because they'd never do it, right? And neither would I, but my brain would try to overprotect everybody around me from never having something horrific happening. So that's the best way I can describe it. And the issue with it, though, is it's fueled by anxiety and panic. You're in a constant state of heightened anxiety to the point where you almost become debilitated and non-functional.
How did you learn what to listen to and what thoughts not to listen to?
Well, it's therapy, really. OCD therapy. There's a therapy called ERP, exposure response. It's cognitive therapy. It's medications. It's a lot of that. And really what you learn is as you do your exposures and your response to what the fear is, until you realize the fear is just a perceived thing in your brain. It's not real. We're learning a lot more about OCD, but I don't want to speak out of turn. I'm not a doctor. Anything I say here, again, I will say, go see a professional. This is just my own experience of what I know. But we're learning that a lot more things are connected to obsessive thinking, and some people are able to manage it better than others.
You're listening to Look Again, Mental Illness Reexamined, a podcast about mental illness brought to you by the BC Schizophrenia Society and our BC partner organizations. I'm Phaedra Aldridge.
And I'm Melissa McKenna. And today we're speaking with former NHL goalie and mental health advocate Corey Hirsch about his lived experience with a mental illness. But before we get back to Corey, I want to mention you can find more information about his book and work as an advocate at coreyhirsch.com.
Now, Corey, you touched on this before. Let's talk about stigma. Can you share your perspective on the stigma still surrounding mental illness and how that's affected your journey?
Well, I mean, it almost killed me, let's be honest. And some people, it does end up going in a bad direction. So why would we continue to stigmatize something that I didn't ask for? I didn't ask for OCD. I didn't ask, you know, more than someone asked for cancer or diabetes or whatever. You don't ask for those things, right? So why am I ashamed for something that I have zero control over, right? I did nothing to deserve it or to have it or whatever. And we have to understand that stigmatizing people can turn deadly. And that's why we need to put an end to it. When we shame people into getting the help that they need, it just buries them even further into despair to the point where it can get hopeless. So that's why we need to end the stigma. And no one's immune to it. It doesn't discriminate. No. So if you're out there thinking that because you're this or that, that you're immune to it, no, we're all susceptible to it. So let's end the stigma to start saving lives. It's about ending suicide. Are we going to ever end suicide? Probably not. But we can put a dent in those numbers. We can help people. Why stigmatize and shame people even further so those numbers grow? Let's end the stigma.
Oh, wow. So you've talked a lot about increasing education to reduce the stigma of mental health, and that you think it should be part of school curriculum to talk about mental health more. How do you see that happening?
Well, it has to be a systematic change. It's continuing to talk about it, and it's continuing to pressure our school systems to teach our kids. Kids are more apt to ask their parents for help, which is great. But the issue for me was that I understand anxiety, depression, and all that, but there are serious mental illnesses out there that start at the age of 7, 8 years old. And these kids don't know what's going on with them. Let's teach them so that they can ask for that help instead of being scared of it. It'd have been so easy to teach me what obsessive compulsive disorder is. It's not hard. This is what it is. It doesn't make you any less of a person. And then a person from there can go, oh, okay, well, this makes sense. I'm going to go get help, right? Let's educate our kids on this stuff.
And these are the facts. That's all we can do is just say these are the facts and these are the signs to look out for.
Absolutely. Why are we withholding that information? What are we gaining by withholding? I've had times where I'm not allowed to go into schools because I talk about suicide in my talks and people think that talking about suicide is going to give someone an idea about suicide. It's been proven that talking about it removes the stigma of it, which encourages people to get help. Not talking about it is what buries people even further. And suicide needs to stop becoming a taboo word. What happens is when you stigmatize somebody that's already suicidal, it just makes them feel even worse about themselves. And that's not what we're trying to do. We're trying to help those people. So stop pretending and dancing around this word. How we're going to create change is by acknowledging that it's out there, acknowledging that it's okay to have these thoughts, and acknowledging that it's not the answer, that there is help available. And we're not going to shame you for having these thoughts. We're going to get you the help that you need.
I think that was really impactful what you said there about symptoms often starting as young as childhood or in your teens, because we talk a lot on the show about the importance of early intervention. And it's hard for somebody to receive that treatment early on if they aren't coming forward and talking to their parents or a teacher or someone else about the symptoms they're experiencing. And when you're a teenager, everything, you're going through puberty, everything's yeah. different. So I can imagine it being challenging to know what you need to be more concerned about versus others. So having that education be, I think, really impactful.
Absolutely. It's like anything. The sooner you can diagnose cancer, the sooner you can diagnose diabetes, the sooner you can diagnose heart disease, the sooner you can diagnose mental health issues, better chance you have,
yeah.
right? That's the bottom line. Why let things grow into a monster that's so big that it becomes hard to treat? No, it can start early in childhood. There's no cure for mental illness. It's not possible. Our brains are what they are, right? But there's tons of treatments available. You can live a great life, even though if you have mental illness, I'm proof of that. There's lots of other people out there that are proof of that. It doesn't need to hold you back. Let's help them out. Let's find a way to teach them how to manage it at a young age.
And speaking of children and teens, looking back now with everything that you've gone through, Corey, what advice would you give your younger self?
God, there's so much. I mean, in terms of mental illness, it would just be that it gets better. You just got to get to tomorrow some days. And that's what I tell everybody. And when you're at tomorrow, and if it's still not good, you just got to get to the next tomorrow, because eventually it gets better, and get the treatment you need. The biggest thing I would probably tell myself is that, hey, life is not linear, right?
Yeah.
You're going to have good, you're going to have bad, you're going to have everything in between. But ultimately, if you do what you need to do and you reach out for help and you get the help you need, it gets better. And that there is always a path ahead. When you've gone to certain areas or places and you find that you're just not getting better or something, keep going, keep searching, because there is always a path ahead. You just need to find it.
Corey, I'm curious. You said that you have three children. How open are you with your kids around your personal struggles?
Oh, they've read my book, so they know. We talk about it quite a bit. One of my daughters, she also struggles with OCD. Mental health and mental illness can be passed genetically. So you have to be aware, but we've always talked about it in our home. My daughter, when she was 15, came to me and she was struggling. And so we got her some help and diagnosis. She got diagnosed with OCD, and she's never gotten to the place that I got to because of early intervention, her feeling comfortable. And what a shame that would be as a parent if I wasn't able to help her and pass on that knowledge that I have. Things could have turned out quite differently for her, right? So education in the homes is absolutely key so that we can start to intervene when kids are younger and get them the help that they need if they need it.
Absolutely. Aside from education in schools, what do you think are some other steps we can make to break down stigma in society, maybe for those of us that are no longer in school?
Yeah, you know what? It's just being open and honest about it. It's not everybody's business, right? If I have something going on with my heart, I don't need to announce it to the world. That's my business. I tell my family, I tell the people I know, but if there's something that I can help somebody with, absolutely, right? There's no shame in speaking about the things that you struggle with. We all have issues. We all have problems. And there's a time and a place, of course, right? I've made everything of mine public because I'm hoping with the platform I have, I can help a lot of people. But I would like to see it normalized where we don't need to talk about it. It doesn't need to be a big coming out. It doesn't need to be a big thing. It becomes normalized where you get the help you need. You don't get stigmatized, but ultimately it's continuing the conversation. It's continuing to have funding and resources and find new treatment options and medications. That's really what we need to do.
Absolutely. And I think what you said earlier is also impactful because I think it was saying that you didn't choose this, that this is just something that happens. And I think a lot of times people, a lot of the stigma is we see someone who struggles with substance use disorders, or we see someone who's maybe at the point with their mental illness where they don't recognize they have an illness and they're living on the streets. And people think they're choosing that life consciously versus that's just the situation. As my dad likes to say, the cards they've been dealt.
I always say this, I live pretty close to Hastings and it's heartbreaking. Every one of those people that are on Hastings are homeless. I guarantee you, if you ask them, they grew up wanting to be doctors and lawyers and hockey players, and they had hopes and dreams just like everybody else. Something traumatic has happened, and they are choosing to deal with it through self-medicating. And that's heartbreaking to me, is because we need to try and help them and find them the proper help. Now, a person has to be part of their own recovery. But we have to understand that shaming them and looking down on them is only pushing them further into despair and pushing them further into self-medication. We need to see that, and we need to have empathy and compassion for them.
Corey, I have to ask, what gave you the courage to come out and talk about your struggles?
I mean, my kids, right? I don't want them to have to go through a mental illness type stigma. So that drives me. And I've had a close person to me take their own life. And it is absolutely the worst, most traumatic, painful thing you could ever imagine. The only thing I could imagine being worse is losing a child, because they take all the answers with them. And I don't want anybody to have to feel that pain that I felt. I don't want anyone to have to feel that hopeless despair that I felt. And we have the ability to change that. It's not like we just throw our arms up. Nah, it's never going to change. We got no control. We do have control over it. We can change that narrative. We can change it to help people. And we can change it to have people not feel so hopeless and full of despair. So that's really what drives me. I'm very thankful for my life. I wouldn't change a thing, to be honest, because it's led me to what I do today, which is being able to help people and being able to be an advocate for mental health.
Corey, thank you so much for having the courage to share your story with us and to continue to share your story. As you said, that is the only way we are going to make a difference when it comes to mental illness. It was an absolute pleasure speaking with you today.
No, and thank you for having me. It's one thing for me to be able to tell my story. It's another to be able to have the channels and avenues that are available to me. And you guys gave me the opportunity to be able to tell mine today. So I appreciate it just as much as you appreciate me coming on. You giving me the opportunity to be able to come and talk to you. It's been a pleasure.
And a huge thanks to you, our audience, for joining us for this episode. Together, we can better understand and change the narrative around mental illnesses like schizophrenia.
To get our latest podcast episode, be sure to hit follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere you listen to podcasts. And to learn more about Corey's work, you can visit his website at coreyhirsch.com.
And this episode wraps up our fourth season of Look Again, Mental Illness Reexamined. It has been a pleasure speaking with all of the knowledgeable and amazing guests this season. We will be back soon. But in the meantime, we want to hear from you. If you have an idea, potential guest, or topic for the next season of Look Again, please let us know. You can email your suggestions to info@bcss.org, or you can message us through any of our social media channels. Thank you so much for listening, for sharing, leaving reviews, and for being a part of these very important conversations. Talk to you soon.
This podcast is brought to you by the BC Schizophrenia Society and the BC Partners for Mental Health and Substance Use Information. We're a group of nonprofit agencies providing good quality information to help individuals and families maintain or improve their mental well-being. The BC Partners members are Anxiety Canada, BC Schizophrenia Society, Canadian Institute for Substance Use Research, Canadian Mental Health Association's BC Division, Family Smart, Jesse's Legacy, the North Shore Family Services Program, and Mood Disorders Association of BC, a branch of Lookout Housing and Health Society. The BC Partners are funded and stewarded by BC Mental Health and Substance Use Services, an agency of the Provincial Health Services Authority. For more information, visit heretohelp.bc.ca.